Thank you. Yeah, so I'm told the students were up very, very, very late last night, beavering away, so they might stagger in as we go along, which is fine. So I'm having a great time here and with very fun discussions, and it's also a great opportunity to be able to say something about what we're trying to do to understand plant form. We primarily work on shoot branching as an example of the extraordinary plasticity that plants have in their morphology, and I want to go quite far back into the background of it and then hopefully eventually get to a bit where we're currently stuck, both micro stuck, which all suggestions welcome, but also some more kind of macro stuck questions where hopefully at some input will be really useful. So I know a lot of people here, some people think about plants, most people think about animals, and I think it's always worth kind of having a bit of a zoom out, because the logic underpinning a lot of the kinds of things people talk about in animal systems is actually significantly different in plant systems, and that's because of the fundamentally different ways in which plants and animals get their kicks, if you want to put it that way. So plants do this rather impressive thing of conjuring themselves out of thin air. Thin air and water, powered by sunlight, build yourself out of nothing. It's kind of extraordinary. And it depends on very high surface area, particularly under the ground, but also obviously over the ground. And as soon as you have a very high surface area under the ground, you can't move. And as soon as you can't move, there are all kinds of other consequences. And a lot of plant development, at least post-embryonic development, I think has to do with dealing with those immobility consequences. And there are two that are important. One that is always mentioned is the requirement to adapt to whatever environmental conditions in which you find yourself because you can't move to a better one. This one, I think, is almost more important, which is that you are absolutely a sitting duck from a predation point of view. So this is a vicious plant predator, as anyone who has a garden knows, but if you're an animal, such as ourselves, we're not overly worried about the predatory capacity of this creature. But because the plant can't move at all, this is a serious problem. And the major consequences for that are that if you're a plant, it has got to be the case that any part of you can be eaten, and you have to not care about that. So any kind of centralized control system, such as a brain, for example, is a very bad idea. So having a brain, if you're a plant, is stupid. And so plants have solved this dual problem in a very cunning way, or rather evolution has solved it for them, and it's substantially through modularity. So plant development post-embryonically is incredibly modular, and the shoot system is a very excellent example of that. So there is this dome of cells at the tip of every growing shoot, the shoot apical meristem, that has stem cells in its center that push daughters to the periphery, where lateral organs such as leaves are initiated, and under it there are stem cells that build the core of the stem, the so-called rib meristem, and then interestingly, at the base of every one of those leaves, there's a whole nother one of these guys initiated. So this is the basic unit of the shoot. It's called the phytoma. It consists of a lateral organ, in this case a leaf, a bit of stem, and an axillary meristem established at the base of the leaf, which is called the axil, just because it is a junction between the leaf and the... It's like armpit, only upside down. And it is, I mean, axil is Latin for armpit, so there you go. So shoots are built up of these phytomers that are churned out by the shoot apical meristem. That's what the meristem does. So you can think of a shoot system as a whole series of these kinds of phytomers. And then because there are these axillary meristems, and the axillary meristems have exactly the same developmental potential as the primary meristem, then you can those meristems can activate and make a whole side shoot, which is exactly the same as this primary shoot. So you wind up with something that's practically, essentially fractal in its nature, and that gives you this extraordinary range of possibilities possibilities. For one genotype, the shoot system can be a single unbranched shoot or this massively ramified bush. You can also decide where and when to put these side branches, huge amounts of flexibility, and at the same time, on this entire system, there are no unique parts. So any bit of this thing can be eaten and it's fine. And in fact, a lot of what we spend our time doing is trying to understand, as I'll get to at great length, the regulation of the activity of these axillary meristems. And as I'll mention again later, one of the key things is whether or not you have other happy meristems. And if you have other happy meristems, then these guys are more likely to stay dormant. Whereas if you're a slug and you've eaten the top of this shoot, it's okay because there are plenty of other meristems and they will respond by activating and essentially replacing that shoot. So, because of this strong modularity, plant development can be incredibly plastic, and that plasticity is substantially dependent on the number of times you iterate these modular productions, so how many modules you make. You can tune the identity of the module, so any shoot structure at all you can interpret in this kind of way, and you know there's all kinds of funky leaves that aren't leaves, and the flowers in Arabidopsis, for example, are essentially axillary meristems with an incredibly suppressed leaf. So all shoot structures you can map onto this kind of phytomer, and so the type of phytomer you can vary, the number of phytomers you can vary, and then what we're primarily interested in is the activity of these secondary meristems, which you can also vary and tune according to the environment, giving you this amazing plasticity. But you have to do your decision making about when to make these transitions, how many things to make, and whether or not to activate your axillary meristems with no central processing because there is no brain. So you've got to do it in a distributed way. So you've got to make decisions. Each little bud, here's an axillary bud that is formed from a few leaf initiations from one of these axillary meristems between the stem and the leaf of an Arabidopsis plant. It can stay dormant or it can activate, and it has to decide whether to do that based on local factors, systemic factors in the plant, all kinds of stuff. And it has to somehow be able to integrate all that information to make its decision. And there is no central site in the plant for that processing. It's a distributed process. So here's one of the things we work on. Apart from chopping the top off the plant, we work a lot on nutrient availability. So if you're growing an Arabidopsis plant, and here is one with ample nitrogen supply, it will make lots of branches. If you grow it with low nitrogen supply, it will make far fewer branches. And you can see actually that there are both developmental patterns for bud activation. So it's the most apical meristems that that activate first after this primary shoot has made the floral transition. And so you have this basipetal sequence of bud activation that stops at some point, so this next bud down has not activated. And that point of stopping in this case is tunable by nitrogen availability. So on low nitrogen, this bud and all of those below have not activated. On high nitrogen, the equivalent bud, which I guess would be this one, is made a branch, and actually also several more of the buds down into this rosette of leaves. So Arabidopsis, before it flowers, the stem elongation is incredibly suppressed. So you wind up with this flat rosette of leaves, each with an axillary meristem. And then post-floral transition, you get this elongating stem that with a few leaves, and then you get this transition to flowering. And at that point, you see this basipetal sequence of bud activation, which stops at some point. And that point, as I said, is environmentally tunable. So how does this bud, in an equivalent position, decide to do something different in this plant than in this plant? That kind of question is what we're interested in. Okay. So as I've already kind of hinted at multiple times, because this is a distributed decision about how many branches the plant should make altogether, there's got to be some kind of communication between all of these meristems as to who's doing what, who, and how many guys should be active and how many guys should not be active. And the evidence that underpins this, it is most intuitive, is the fact that if you chop the top off this plant, then previously dormant axillary meristems in the axils of the leaves below will activate and grow out. And this is a phenomenon that we've known about for 100 and something years, and that is generally referred to as apical dominance, because the primary apex dominates, and when you chop it off, the subordinate axillary meristems can activate. And most people know about this because it's the basis of pruning in your garden. If you want to make your roses bushy, you chop the leading shoot off and the other guys grow out. And for almost as long as people have worked on apical dominance as an experimental system, at least, it's been known that auxin, which has cropped up before, because as Jen says, if you're working on plants, you are working on auxin, whether you like it or not. auxin, which is this relatively simple molecule here, is a key and central component of the information flow that underpins apical dominance. So auxin is synthesized in young expanding leaves. That's its major site of synthesis in the shoot. And it is exported from the leaves and transported basipetally down the plant by a system of very beautiful transporters whose behavior is really key to this entire process. So one of those transporters, which has received a huge amount of attention, is in the so-called pin family of transporters. And that family has received a huge amount of attention because the proteins are very polarly localized, or at least polarly localizable. And this is a hand section through a transgenic Arabidopsis plant where pin 1 protein has been fused to GFP, and you can see it basally localized in files of cells adjacent to the main vasculature of the stem, which, if you're a plant aficionado, you can spot by these weird spiral things, which are the spiral thickening of the cell walls as they begin to differentiate into xylem vessels. But the basic idea is these basipetal, strongly basipetally localized, strongly basally localized auxin efflux carriers, and it's this basal localization of the efflux carriers that results in the unidirectional movement of auxin down the stem.
And the vascular system does nothing vis-a-vis signaling?
No, that's not entirely true. But from an auxin transport in the shoot point of view, the auxin, there is some auxin moving in the phloem, which is also potentially going down to the roots. There is some evidence that that's an important pathway for delivery of auxin from the shoot way down to the root tip. There is no evidence that that auxin has any role in the shoot. But there are quite a number of signals that move up the plant in the xylem that contribute to shoot branching control, and I'll get to one of those later.
In the distance between the two bars of one cell?
Yes. So these are very long, thin cells. They're a couple of hundred microns.
How long?
A couple of hundred microns. And most of the stuff in the middle is vacuole. And that causes all kinds of headaches when you try to model it, because you never know what to do with the vacuole, of course.
So how do I read this picture with the blue arrows? So is auxin conserved so that and all the leaves are adding to auxin, so flux of auxin is actually
The degradation rate for auxin in this pathway is very low. The synthesis is much higher in expanding leaves, so once the leaves have stopped expanding, they are typically exporting a lot less auxin, so there's that going on. But any active axillary shoots will also be exporting auxin, and that will join this common stream, which is a key part of the system that I will get to later. So some of the reasons why we know that auxin moving in this system is so important are these experiments where you chop the top off the plant, and if you replace the decapitated top with a daub of auxin, so you're maintaining this auxin flow, then these axillary buds will, even if they expand slightly in a excited opportunity to get going, will then stop and not grow out. And so this unidirectional transport system is extremely important in delivering the information or transferring information from the shoot down the plant. As I will get to at great length later, that leaves you with an interesting question, because the auxin doesn't go up into the bud. So if you use radioactive auxin in this kind of experiment, you can monitor it going straight down the stem. Hardly any of it gets into the bud. And certainly no more of it gets into the bud than if you feed it in through the bottom, where it whooshes up through this transpiration stream in the xylem. And if you do that, there is no effect whatsoever on the activity of this bud. So it's the movement of auxin in the main stem that is somehow doing the job. So just a kind of brief recap on auxin transport, because it's so important in the system and it has these rather interesting properties. So auxin, we're back to auxin, is over here, and it's kind of a weak acid. Here it is. And in that extracellular space, which is called the apoplast in plants, that the pH is quite acidic, it's quite low, and so this molecule tends to be protonated, and in its protonated form can cross the plasma membrane relatively straightforwardly because it's not charged. There are also some uptake carriers which can greatly increase the rate of uptake, and they're kind of important in getting the stuff into cells. But inside the cell, the pH is much higher, and this is almost completely ionized, and so it can't get out. So it's an acid trap mechanism, and its inability to get out in this form means that polarly localized efflux carriers such as PIN1 can result in this very strong directional transport just because of this trap. The other thing that is always worth pointing out in the context of this system is that people quite often talk about auxin diffusing into cells, and that gives you the impression that it's all going to be very concentration gradient dependent and so on. It isn't, because of this acid trap phenomenon. So auxin will go into the cell and ionize, and so auxin will continue to come into the cell even if there's a shed load inside and hardly any outside. Okay, so this system is very interesting, and it's very dependent then on the polarity of these pin proteins as to how auxin is shuffled around through the plant, and as I've hopefully convinced you, how information therefore flows about active shoot apices above you. Because if you're an active apex, you've got young expanding leaves, you're making lots of auxin, it's being exported coming down this system. So that blue arrow in the stem is information about how many active shoots there are above you. And So there are lots of key and interesting questions about how these pin proteins get polarized, and I would say that that was one of the burning questions in plant biology. There are many, many processes which depend on pin polarization, and we really have, in my opinion, extraordinarily poor understanding of how that happens. There's, you know, all kinds of people working on phosphorylation of this, that, or the other, and it has an effect, but really not anything resembling a synthesis of how it might work. That is widely useful across tissues. And actually, modelling has been extraordinarily important in trying to understand at least the regulatory logic of these polarisation processes. And there are a number of kind of different models that allow you to reproduce the behaviour of pins in real systems. And one of the interesting questions is trying to match those up with experimental data. And one of those models comes from a series of experiments done in the 70s and 80s by Tzvi Sachs in Israel, who was very brilliant, in my opinion, plant physiologist, who identified an awful lot of kind of self-organizing behaviors for auxin flows in the shoot long before we knew anything about pins. And it turns out that those self-organizing behaviors can be mapped very nicely onto the self-organizing behaviors of pin proteins in the context of auxin. And the kind of classic Sachs experiment is kind of recapitulated here in the modern era, so that Sachs papers are full of little diagrams that look like this, only they're not green because it was pre-color printing. And this is supposed to be a bit of pea stem, and this is the existing vascular strands. And if you stick a razor blade into this pea stem and interrupt this vascular strand, then go away and come back, what you observe is that there is a healing process such that vascular strands will now, contiguous with this apical one, have developed round the cut and reattached to the existing strand. So there's this extraordinary healing property that plants have, again, due to their vulnerability to damage by predators, presumably from an evolutionary point of view. And so Sachs was very interested in how that process happened, and through a bunch of very elegant experiments, applying auxin here, there, and everywhere, and looking at what goes on, he came up with this concept of that's called auxin transport canalization. And the core tenets are that auxin both upregulates and polarizes its own transport. So if you have a passive, an initial passive flux of auxin from a strong source to a sink, then that flux will be increased and focused through this positive feedback between the flux, because the transporters will be both upregulated and they will be polarized in the direction of the flux. And so in this model, the polarization of pin proteins is dependent on the flux of auxin across membranes. And if you have lots of flux going across a membrane, then lots of pin proteins will go there. And that is one of the big questions that I will get to at the end, because nobody has any idea how that works. And it's interesting, because now there's huge amounts of plant biology that are built on that idea.
The pin export of the auxin,
yep.
Is it going just to the extracellular space,
yep.
Or not into the next cell?
No. Goes into the extracellular space, has to get taken up again by the next cell. There's lots of interesting... So I mean, the other thing that we desperately need are really good in vivo auxin reporters. So live imaging auxin reporters for how much auxin there is inside cells and how much auxin there is outside cells. At the moment, all we have is essentially transcriptional reporters. We got a little bit further upstream than that, but it's basically how much auxin do you have in your nucleus. And that is just not enough to understand these things. We need to know how much is in the extracellular spaces and how far it can move in extracellular spaces and all of that stuff.
There's a question over there.
Sorry. I'm missing one boundary condition at the bottom. What happens? Is that a pure sink?
In the chute at the bottom, it's very cool. The auxin goes all the way down to the root, and then it cycles around in the bottom of the root like this, and is very important in regulating both the rate of root growth and the ability of the root to bend in response to gravity and things like that. And there is a significant amount of degradation in that loop, so that it's not that it builds up infinitely through the
loop. Okay. Where does it go when it cycles?
Where does it go?
When it cycles, so it reached all the way.
It goes all down to the root tip, just in the kind of core of the root meristem, and then it's transported laterally, and then it goes back up through the epidermal, the root cap and then the epidermal layers, and then it's transported back into that central strand just at the point where cells exit the meristem and start elongating. Goes back down to the tip again. And that reflux loop, the dynamics of it are quite important in regulating root growth. And as I say, there's a fair amount of degradation in that system, and also some local synthesis kind of, so you can locally tune it as well. But it's an important point of information input from the shoot to the root.
So it just goes all the way to the apical site, right? All the way to the top of the
root. No. So this is another... Sorry. another one of the joys of plant biology is that the tip of the root, which is way at the bottom, is also called an apex, because it's the apex of the root, even though it's going down.
There's been it cycles from the root.
Exactly. So it goes all the way down from the shoot to the bottom of the root, and then it cycles over about a millimeter, I guess, in the root is the root tip, which is where
again,
that.
Again, with no consumption of staple, right?
No, there is consumption in that, and there is more degradation in the root in that system. And as I say, the total amount in that part of the root is a balance between the stuff coming from the shoot, the stuff made locally, and the stuff being degraded. And all of those things are tunable by the environment and all of that stuff to allow your root to do all those kind of things. I'm relying on people like Jen to leap in if I get anything wrong. Good. Okay. So this is, and all of that's driven by pins polarized in cool ways. And that tells you that there are multiple different ways to polarize pins, almost certainly. But because we love physics, and we also think that grand unifying theories are good, we're quite keen on the idea that there might be some kind of overarching regulatory heuristic that would help us deal with all these multiple different ways to polarize pins. But in the meantime, we are that people tend to focus on particular ones, and the particular one that I'm obsessed by, as we will see later, because it helps me with all kinds of stuff in shoot branching control, is this thing called canalization. So if you make this cut, there's auxin coming down this stem, and it will build up here. So then this will be a very good source for auxin, because there will be a build-up behind this cut, because there's a razor blade sitting in here. If you... on this side, any auxin that's there will continue to be carried away by the polar pins. So this becomes a fabulous sink. So now you've got a source here and a sink here, and according to this canalization theory, we should see a passive movement of auxin from here to here, and that this passive movement will be will result in upregulation of these exporters and their polarization between here and here. And Sachs came up with this idea, as I say, long before there were pins, and then when there were, we knew about pins and could detect them, and people started to recapitulate his experiments looking for pins. They did exactly what he said they should do. So here is one of these experiments. This is in P, because it's much easier to do these experiments in P, because they're big, but transgenesis in P is virtually impossible. So this is not GFP, this is an antibody staining of pin. So pin is... basically localized in these vascular, here's that nice spirally stuff that I told you about before, and here is the basally localized pins in this box that would be the same up here. Here's the cut that's just gone in, and then above the cut, sometime later, you begin to see laterally polarized pins. They've reoriented and are now pointing that way, which is the direction of auxin flux there. And then you can see the upregulation here in this part of the tissue where there really wasn't so much before. And it kind of bending back round, connecting up with the source down here. So in the end, you wind up with these files of cells, contiguous files of cells with highly polar pin that go around connecting the existing vasculature from above and below the cut. And then some of those files will differentiate as vasculature and will heal around the cut. So this idea of flux-correlated pin allocation is quite robust in all kinds of experiments. Lots of questions.
If I understand it correctly, you first have to make cells and then polarize.
No, the cells are mostly there already. The wound will also induce some cell division to create new cells to plug the gap. But actually, where you're making the new strand is in this tissue that isn't massively damaged. So you can also plug a gap up with cells and they can differentiate. But there's lots of reprogramming of cells and repolarization of existing cells as well.
So to make this work, plant relies on passive transport, this transit, right?
Yes.
But with auxin trapping, we're not exactly told how auxin can get out without the polarized pin.
Yeah.
So are there just unpolarized pins, or there is leakage?
Yeah, so and this notion of the passive transport is problematic precisely because of this acid trap thing. There's a whole other family of transporters that are called that are in the ABCB family, which animal people know about because they're quite generic, but there's a family in Arabidopsis that will export auxin, and they are apolar. And so one possibility is that they're very important for this straightforward concentration-dependent movement. All of these things exist in big families, and so getting clean genetics to test these things is virtually impossible. And when you take out a couple of the ABCBs that are particularly important in the stem, the plant is so sick you really don't know what you're looking at anyway. And yeah, so... you can come up with ideas that are okay, but testing them turns out to be a little bit frustratingly difficult. Yes?
So is the repolarization of the cells downstream of auxin reflow, or vice versa? Is the auxin reflow which is upstream?
Well, both, because it's feedback.
Yes, but there's something that starts, right?
The flow comes first, essentially.
The flow comes first.
Yes. That's the idea.
In the second panel, we should see like more diffuse lower pins everywhere on the left of the cut. I'm not sure what we're supposed to see in the second panel.
Here. One might expect to see. I'm not sure I would okay, so you can, you know, you can worry about what's going on here. I don't think the quality of the data are really up there to make that kind of nuance. But I as I say, the Sachs experiment says lots of them, and they're very elegant, and they're about putting auxin in all kinds of places, and you get vascular differentiation, and every time anyone's been able to reproduce those, the pins follow what Sachs said. It's very nice. So, which will allow me to get onto another Sachs experiment, which is the one that kind of got us thinking about this entire system in the context of shoot branching control. So, this is a Sachs experiment where he made a little notch in the stem here. Here's the existing vascular strand, and he put a blob of auxin here on the side, and then you go away and you come back, and this is a source for auxin, this is a great sink for auxin, so all of this stuff goes on between this source and this sink, and you will get vascular connection between this local auxin application site and the existing vascular strand. If you do this but you simultaneously apply auxin to the existing vascular strand, then this existing vascular strand is a much less good sink than in this case over here, because it's all full of its own lovely auxin. And then either you get some vaguely wandering vascular differentiation into this tissue that doesn't really go anywhere, or actually more often you get nothing when you apply this local source. And to us, that looked very similar to the situation where you have an axillary bud out here, which is potentially a fabulous auxin source. If it were active, it would be making expanding leaves and making a load of auxin. And the existing so-called polar auxin transport stream in the stem, with lots of basal pin 1 taking the pin basally. So this potentially is a very good auxin sink, unless, of course, it's already full of auxin coming from more apical shoots. And so through this positive feedback process between auxin flux and pin polarization, you could establish exactly one of these going from this axillary bud out into the main stem and down to the root. And if it turns out that establishing that canalized auxin transport from the bud apex into the stem is actually necessary for the bud to be active, then you immediately have a rather nice system whereby auxin moving in the main stem can inhibit the activity of this axillary bud without it having to go up into the bud. Yes?
So this requires somehow that the stem has a limited capacity to...
Interestingly, it doesn't. This was a kind of big debate that emerged afterwards, because when we originally proposed the idea, we talked about capacity. We have a long-standing rivalry with a group in Australia who don't believe a word of what we say, so which has been super helpful. They demonstrated, super helpfully, that there is no capacity limit in the stem, no obvious capacity limit anyway. But actually, it turns out from the modelling you don't really need that. What is going on here is it's a competitive process, and I'll get to our model shortly, and you'll hopefully be able to see that. Okay, what that means is that there's auxin flow through the shoot, with auxin being exported from young expanding leaves, but also from obviously active shoots. And all of this auxin, ultimately, even in higher order branches, will wind up moving down the main stem towards the root. And so you have a system where the entire shoot system is potentially connected via its need to contribute auxin to this basipetal transport stream down to the root. Why it is that one of these axillary meristems might need to export auxin to be active is another big unanswered question, and certainly a weakness in our model. One attractive hypothesis is that, as may have been covered earlier and will certainly be covered later, there's a whole other auxin patterning system that's self-organizing and depends on the transport system, but a completely different mechanism for polarization, unless we can think of some way to unify them, where auxin is concentrated into small areas on the flanks of the shoot apical meristem, and it's that triggers leaf initiation. And after that, triggering of the leaf initiation, as the leaf begins to grow, then the auxin that's been accumulated is transported internally, and that process looks very canalization-like. So you could argue that if you can't canalize auxin export out of this meristem and away somehow or other, this whole leaf initiation process might get messed up because there's nowhere for the auxin to go in that patterning process. But that's speculation. Okay, so here's canalization theory. Quite early on, actually, canalization was modeled by Graham Mitchison, who worked together with Svi Sachs. And they were mostly worrying about the role of this process in patterning leaf venation, which is another topic for several other days. But the basic idea is that there is this positive feedback. So if you have a cell here with a certain amount of auxin there, and you have a passive flux between this cell and this cell, that flux, which is illustrated by this white bar, will result in insertion of pin proteins, these red things, into this membrane, and that will, of course, increase the flux, and then you have this positive feedback. And the maths has typically been written like this, although again the evidence for exactly why it's like this rather than anything else is mostly because this works and other things don't, rather than because we absolutely know that this is the way this is the geometry of pin allocation. So the key components are that the change in pin is these two terms, which is insertion. This is a basal term, which seems fine. This is the kind of nuts and bolts of the equation, really, in that this is the flux correlated term. And the bit that's kind of made up is that correlated flux correlated insertion is modeled as a Hill function. And that sigmoidal insertion proportional to flux is important because it's the thing that gives this whole system its bistability that I'll get onto shortly. And then there's a pin removal term, which is linear and just proportional to how much pin there is in there. And so this gives a bistable switch where you wind up with a stable off state, essentially, with very low flux, and a stable on state with very high flux, and flip between these two. It's quite fun speaking at a meeting where you don't have to explain this slide. Actually, this thing, we started modeling with Zemek, Pooch, and Kievich in Calgary a long time ago, who is a devotee of L systems, which I think have also come up before. So the main model we have actually doesn't have any equations in it at all. It's an L system, and it looks like this. So this is the root of the plant, which is modeled as the kind of ultimate sink. The auxin goes there and mysteriously vanishes. And then this is a little seedling where we kind of abstract a phytomer almost as a giant cell. So here it is. With a certain amount of auxin and a certain amount of pin. And here is the meristem that's going to add phytomers. We don't model the leaves explicitly. We model the axillary meristems as another one of these. And the whole point about L systems is they're an iterative rewrite grammar, so you can build a growing organism with an L system. And this is what ought to happen here. You're going to do it? Yes, I'll do it like this. And so you build these things. I wonder if I can stop it doing this as well. No, I can't. So you build the shoot, and the axillary meristems emerge, and those meristems can accumulate auxin. But because there's a lot of auxin here, the flux between here and here is not high enough to get you over that instability into the stable on state. And then what we say is that so. Don't understand. Can you do it? Yes. So here they are, inactive. And then we argue that at flowering, the auxin production goes down a lot, and that results in dropping auxin here, which allows this bud to activate, and this bud will then flower, which results in a drop of auxin, and it drains away, and then the next bud will be able to go, and so on and so forth. So this ridiculously simple model then recapitulates the basipetal sequence of bud activation that we see on flowering involving almost no parameters at all, which is very satisfying, although obviously a massive oversimplification. In this particular simulation, the amount of auxin being made by a floral shoot is modeled as very low, and as a result, every single one of these buds activates, and it will keep going. But if you increase the amount of residual auxin production, then you can persuade that basipetal sequence to stop at some point, and that point will be the point when the contribution of auxin from the active apices is enough here to prevent sufficient flux from the next bud down to let the thing kick off.
Can you go back to your equation for a second? Staring at the flux term, and I lost track where auxin is itself, right? Because the dynamics that you showed depends explicitly on concentration, right? Mm-hmm. In there, I don't see anything for auxin concentration, only auxin flux.
Yes, there is nothing for concentration.
That says that flux is proportional to pin times auxin concentration or something?
So one of the things I rather like this about this equation is it's got nothing to do with auxin concentration. It's only to do with auxin flux. And that
is sort of remarkable and not at all obvious.
Yeah.
But your simulation has explicit auxin dependence.
It has auxin dependence
except
because
when the level of auxin changes.
Yes.
I don't understand how this equation knows about it.
Because the relative concentration between here and here is essentially allowing this flux.
But so the flux is not diffusive. I'm looking for some relation between flux and auxin.
Yes.
Right. And one thing is to say that it's auxin times the pin.
Yeah.
Right. So pin is pumping auxin.
This is exactly a super pertinent question, which the model depends on the flux between here and here being related to the source sink strength, essentially, and how that is sensed if you can't have straightforward diffusion is not straightforward. It's not impossible, but it's also not straightforward because there are these global non-regulated efflux carriers and so on and so forth. And the entire question of flux sensing and its relationship to concentration sensing is something that many people have spent a lot of time tearing their hair out over.
But you can't just integrate the fluxes in time and get a concentration. You can imagine that your flux solution has going with it a concentration in the field that you infer. It's not obvious that it's positive integer, et cetera.
So it's absolutely true that the flux sensing mechanism could really be a concentration sensing mechanism if it managed to sense concentration in two different times and figure them out together, for example. And this is this is one of the big questions: is what could this flux sensing mechanism be, and or at least this thing that allocates pin in a flux-correlated way be. I'll keep going some more data of relevance to this will emerge, put it that way. Okay, so all of this is quite speculative and has these huge problems as quite correctly identified. And so I don't think I would believe any of it, or at least be nearly so excited about any of it, were it not for this stuff. So this is another hormone called strigalactone, which we have contributed to understanding through starting in a very kind of straightforward genetic screen way when I started my lab many years ago. What we looked for mutants that didn't regulate their branching properly, and we came up with some mutants that we called MAX for more axillary growth, and they were very branchy. And to cut many long stories short, it transpires that these mutants are involved in the synthesis or perception of another hormone called strigalactone, and this is one that moves up the plant in the transpiration stream. And it's made throughout the entire plant, but is made at very high levels in roots and is involved in nutrient sensing in various ways. So it's actually quite important for allowing the plant to tune its branching in response to different nutrient availability. So, big deal in this whole process. Now, I'm going to focus on one of the mechanisms of action at strigalactone because it's the one that's relevant to auxin transport. There's a whole other mechanism which is transcriptional, which I'm barely going to talk about at all. I actually suspect that even that transcriptional mechanism in the end feeds back into this auxin transport system. But there are two parallel pathways which work as a kind of coherent feed-forward system through which strigalactone signals. So here it is, it's being going up the plant in the transpiration stream, which means it's delivered directly into buds, but it's actually everywhere. It's delivered across the whole shoot. And if you look in those stem segments where you can see pin proteins, if you add this synthetic strigalactone that's called GR24, what you see is a very rapid reduction within about 20 minutes of pin protein accumulation on the plasma membrane. This is a strigalactone biosynthesis mutant, the one I just showed you, which over-accumulates these pin proteins very strongly. They're still polar, they're less polar. This background is probably it desperately trying to get rid of the extra stuff that it winds up making. And if you add strigalactone to this, you reduce the pin protein levels. This is a strigalactone signaling mutant, which also over-accumulates pin proteins, and obviously when you add strigalactone, nothing happens because it can't see it. So what that means is you can model strigalactone as the pin removal constant, and most of our evidence suggests that what it's doing is triggering clathrin-mediated endocytosis of pin from the plasma membrane in a completely transcription-independent way very quickly. And so if you model strigalactone as pin removal, then you can model a strigalactone mutant as having very low mu, and if you do that, effectively what happens is you lift this entire curve up. This point disappears, so you no longer have a stable off, and this point goes along here, so your stable on involves higher flux. And in the model it looks like this, where you have more branches, which I've shown you. You have more pin accumulation, which I've shown you. And you also have this rapid, massive accumulation of auxin as you go down the stem, because something I haven't mentioned is that auxin synthesis in leaves and buds is under feedback inhibition. So if you can get rid of more, you can make more. And we've measured that, and it is the case. Okay. So this model was beginning to look exciting then in terms of actually telling us something interesting. And so we were interested in whether we could have access to any of these other parameters that we could tune genetically. So we started to look for genes involved in pin insertion that other people had found already. And we wound up with two. One of them is an ARF-GEF called NOM, which is involved in vesicle cycling, which has a trouble accumulating pins on its plasma membrane, and another is a very mysterious protein called TIR3, which is also called big because it's huge and crops up. Somebody was mentioning, I was quite excited, somebody early in the week mentioned a protein that cropped up in every single genetic screen that was involved in vesicle trafficking. This is a protein that crops up in every single genetic screen that is involved in vesicle trafficking. It's the same kind of idea. And one of the things it seems to do is have problems delivering pins. And the double mutants have essentially additive phenotypes in terms of pin accumulation that you can see here, which kind of suggests they might be working independently. So our idea that, which arm wave, they might not be, but you know, that this might be mu and this might be something rho-ish, and that would be good. So so if we decide that these are something to do with rho, then we can start looking in parameter space and make some predictions. So in terms of auxin transport, if you have varying levels of pin removal on this axis and varying levels of pin insertion on this axis, and what we're measuring in the third axis is how much auxin transport there is through a big chunk of stem that we can measure by adding auxin, radiolabeled auxin in through the top, then we have access to these points on the graph, essentially. So here's a strigalactone mutant, which has very low pin removal. in a wild-type background, so it has perfectly fine pin insertion. Here's wild-type. Here is wild-type plus strigalactone, so we've upped the pin removal rate. And then you can move this whole line down here for something that has a pin insertion problem in the background, so we have a lower pin insertion rate. And this particular graph is completely straightforward and intuitive and lovely and looks fine. And if you're over here, you have lots of auxin transport, and if you're down here, you don't have very much auxin transport.
I'm confused about the model. Where is the positive feedback in your model?
Where is the positive feedback? Oops.
Like, don't you have to specify how this flux depends on?
So we are essentially flux and pin is much the same thing in the model, because pin is doing the flux.
Okay, so I could imagine replacing pin in that thing by flux, and
yes,
then you get a one equation.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. But we put pin in here because that cheers biologists up, because they know what that is.
Sort of answers. You're not saying anything about auxin, but you are saying that flux is pin, basically.
Yes, and the thing that's fluxing is auxin. But we're not saying anything about auxin concentration.
No, the flux would be zero, even if
there, right, if there was no difference in auxin, then flux would be zero, but you're not modeling that.
Well, you just assume that auxin is constant here, right?
You assume
just imagine for a moment that auxin was constant, and the flux was pin times auxin.
You're saying the pattern of auxin is not changing, so I can, whatever the difference is, it's based
on the fluctuation.
So this will give you an instantaneous pattern of fluxes, right? But to show how something regrows, you need also boundary conditions. Okay.
But this equation just tells you that there is bistability. Yeah. And now, as a function of auxin, you can also, this equation will tell you that you can go through bistability. Because precisely what relates
in and okay, so you measure the auxin transports and it does what you think, and it's all very easy. This is the fun parameter space exploration. So this is branching, and here branching is the number of branches, and the number of branches is the number of buds that manage to achieve canalized auxin transport. So the number of buds that get into the stable high flux state. And here, things are not nearly so intuitive. And you find you've got two distinct ways to be branchy. You've got the low mu way, so low pin removal. So any pin that goes in the plasma membrane stays there, which drives you across into the stable on state very quickly because no removal. And then you've got this, and this kind of gets back a little bit to this concentration issue. This is the low in. This is a kind of low insertion thing, which means that every active bud is exporting relatively little auxin because it has low insertion, and that means it's less good at inhibiting the guys underneath it. And so. This is very non-intuitive, and I must say this is the only time so far when I've done the thing that everybody says that happens with modeling, which is you have a non-intuitive prediction that you can then test. And the non-intuitive prediction is if you take this genotype and you add increasing levels of strigalactone, you should see a reduction in branching, followed by an increase in branching, followed by a reduction in branching. And so we did that experiment, and astonishingly, it worked. So the first thing is just to show you that everything's branchy. Here's everything, all the mutants being branchy, as you might imagine. And then this is the up-down experiment. So here it is. Here's the tier 3 mutant, either in a wild-type or a strigalactone background. And when you add strigalactone, you can promote branching and then inhibit branching. And what that means is, although where I drew it here, I was expecting this. In this point has got to be somewhere down that slope, after all, rather than right on top of it, and why should it be? But the general idea of down, up, down is maintained in the model, and in the tier 3 background you only see the up. In the max mutant background you see the down, up, down, which is what you would predict from the graph I just showed. And for me, I am particularly keen on this experiment because it's an experiment in which adding strigalactone promotes branching, and that is not possible to deliver as an outcome with the alternative models, which is that strigalactone is a branch inhibitor that goes into buds and turns them off. And that transcriptional model works much more straightforwardly in that way, but this says that that transcription model is not sufficient. And actually this gets back a little bit to this issue of auxin concentration, because the thing I really like about this system, this whole auxin transport based system working via canalization, is that it this kind of competitive canalization is potentially then a fantastic signal integrator. It depends on the source strength of auxin in the bud and the sink strength for auxin in the stem, which you could tune in various ways, and on the dynamics of this feedback loop. It is entirely relative and not dependent on absolute auxin concentrations, involves dynamic tunability, but of course can achieve steady state, and you could potentially integrate systemic changes with local things. And actually this is where the kind of strigalactone system potentially feeds in quite well, because if strigalactone is produced in roots in nutrient starvation, which it is, and is transported up to the shoots, then essentially what nutrient starvation is doing is globally increasing mu, which makes it globally harder to activate your bud, and you'll wind up activating fewer buds. It tells you nothing about which buds should activate. That could be mediated by local factors or by who got their first factors, but it creates this very nice, in my opinion, regulatory logic. And what the regulatory logic is essentially competition with reinforcement, and the other kind of nice thing about that is that's exactly what rewires your brain in response to activities. And so in the context of this kind of decision-making process mirroring animal developmental processes, the engineering principle underneath it is exactly the same thing. So I'm keen on this idea.
Hello. Is pin 1 a weak attenuator?
Sorry?
Is pin 1 a weak attenuator?
Is pin 1 the...
Pin 1, the transporter, a weak attenuator?
I can't catch the last word in your sentence.
So auxin promotes a weak attenuation, right? So it activates a weak atten ligase.
Yes, so that's the transcriptional pathway for auxin.
But not necessarily transcriptional, right?
So is it ubiquitinated? Is that what you're asking?
Yes.
Pin 1, there is no evidence that pin 1 is ubiquitinated. There is some evidence that pin 2 is ubiquitinated, but no evidence that pin 2 has anything to do with this system. Pin 2 polarization is
I'm thinking about the alpha factor receptor in yeast, which you can polarize, right?
Yeah. So, we've thought about that in various ways. We've actually thought about it partly in the context of how strigalactone takes pins off membranes as well, because strigalactone also signals through targeted protein degradation. But actually we think that, we know that the strigalactone signaling that's important is in the nucleus, so something else is secondarily coming out into the... cytoplasm. Okay, how are we doing for time? But that's a fun thing to get back to if I manage to get to the end, and I might try and skip through so that I definitely do. Okay, so this is to make the point that I suppose I sort of just made, is that strigalactone then is coming up from the root, but also can be locally made in the shoot, and is being systemically distributed and modifying the entire properties of the kind of substrate on which this competition and with reinforcement is being mediated. And you can see that, I think, quite nicely. We work quite a lot with these kind of what we think of as minimal shoot systems. So it's a little bit of stem segment that we've cut out of the plant with just two leaves. And so you're essentially competing the two buds off one another. And if you just take those things off the plant, chop the top off, and let them go, typically what happens is either both of them will grow, or the top one will grow and inhibit the bottom one. We also find, with less probability but nonetheless it's possible, the bottom one can grow and inhibit the top one. And we use this rather clunky and about to be refined metric, which we call the relative growth index, which is the growth of the longest bud divided by the growth of both of them. And in a wild-type plant, you get this bimodal distribution of these and these between half and one. If you feed strigalactone in through the bottom, typically what happens primarily is you wind up with loads of these and none of these. You also do see some effects on the elongation of these, but not much. And you never see something where neither bud grows. So it's the competition between them that's being tuned more than just grow, don't grow. And this is the strigalactone receptor mutant that always does this, whether or not you give it strigalactone, unless one of the buds dies in one plant. Okay. So all of that... now, we can do two things now. I think I'll try and say something about this and then try and have a bigger discussion at the end. So all of that I like. It has all kinds of... it explains all kinds of quite difficult to explain data. It has all kinds of quite nice properties, but it is obviously hopelessly oversimplistic. And this is in my kind of journey as a modeler, which is a very short journey relative to most people in the room. I like that. It's been super useful. It's given us experimental designs, all the rest of it. But now you have to take the next step, which is to start introducing a higher level of accuracy to give you access to more things in the experiments. And then now it gets uncomfortable for me, because you weren't like with lots of parameters, and as soon as you have lots of parameters, it's a nightmare. So I'm interested in how one navigates this transition, and I'll tell you where we've got to so far. And also we've got stuck in what I consider to be quite an interesting place. So looking at this, I've described it, we like it. It suggests that this bud is going to activate by establishing auxin transport out into the stem. And as we discussed, there are issues with how that works, because somehow or other, you have to have a flux dependent on the source sink relationships that isn't diffusive. So how does that work? So we've started to think about that in a number of ways. And the thing we've mostly focused on is trying to understand better the way the auxin transport system in the stem works, so the dynamics of that, partly because PIN1 is expressed in those vascular associated cells, but most of the tissue between the bud and the stem in this bit here is not vascular, and there's relatively little PIN1 expressed there. So we became interested in, you know, what's going on at this junction where the potentially any auxin coming out of the bud meets the stem before it gets to the polar auxin transport stream with the PIN1. So we wanted to understand better the auxin transport dynamics in the stem. So most of the auxin transport data I've shown you so far are based on assays that look something like this, where you take a little bit of stem and you stick it upside down in a tube with radio-labeled auxin, and then you count how much auxin gets to this end after about 6 hours is the time we use. So we wanted to get some more information about the movement of the auxin in the meantime, so we used this pulse assay, where we stuck it in the end for 10 minutes, and then we transferred it to buffer, which I now regret, because I would rather have put cold auxin in there, but the standard assay we used just has buffer. And then you cut it into little pieces and you count the auxin in all the pieces. And the results look like this. So this is 30, 60, 90, 120, 150, 180 minutes. And virtually all the auxin gets to the end of the stem, but there's a kind of flat and diminishing amount that it stays in the middle over time. A little bit seems to be trapped in the apex, which I'll mention again later, but that's okay. And so that all looks good. In the early time points, what happens is quite interesting. In the very early time points, you have a nice peak. But even with a nice peak, there's auxin moving at this kind of rate, which is the rate that the literature says auxin moves at. But there's actually a fair amount of auxin moving 3 times faster at this kind of rate. And that nice peak, you can't see, really, after an hour. it flattens very quickly. And by 90 minutes, it's almost totally flat. And then after that, what happens is all of this auxin gradually trundles along to the end. And so, yeah.
The time here is relative to the transfer to the buffer.
Yeah. So all the time is it's actually 40, 90, whatever.
This auxin level, therefore, I should differentiate to get the fluxes.
This is auxin level. This just counts. Yes. Yes, we haven't done that, interestingly.
Can you just go in opposite direction on a slide? So there is, now maybe the next one. So in that experiment you replace, so there is presumably some, so again, how do I read this? There is some delay when the auxin, so radio-labeled auxin eventually replaces all other auxin. There is no other source of auxin.
There is no other source of auxin. We've
and
done
some time constant for that to happen.
Yes. So as I say, I for various reasons we'll get to. We now definitely need to do this experiment where we put cold auxin in here instead of buffer. We weren't anticipating that being an issue when we started with the whole thing, but it looks like it might be, so that's kind of fun. And we know quite a lot about auxin drainage by directly measuring endogenous auxin, and the way drainage happens matches quite well onto how this auxin behaves. And there is some evidence that you activate some low level of auxin synthesis. So more auxin, if you wait long enough, more auxin comes out at the bottom than there was in at the beginning, if you see what I mean. And auxin synthesis can happen everywhere, we know, so that's kind of...
Can you show you the next slide, the transient? So it first flattens and then it collects at the kind of root site, right? So your top of the plant or the apical side is on the left here, right?
Yes.
And so...
It can't go anywhere here because, it's just... there's nowhere for it to go. But if this were a real plant, it would have disappeared off to the root. So the
it does look quite discontinuous in between 19 and 120 minutes. Right? That suddenly accumulates at the base.
Yes, I think. Well, I think that just reflects the time window when the first auxin would have got to the bottom. And so we have a sort of slightly clunky model for this, and in various forms. We modeled it as just pin 1 all by itself, pin 1 kind of channel surrounded by some tissue that was doing nonpolar auxin, or a kind of pin 1 type high polar auxin surrounded by tissue that does less polar transport, surrounded by tissue that does none. And this is based partly on data for what transporters are where. And the way it's modeled, we've again got several different sorts by now. This is a relatively old slide where we have auxin moving directly from one cell to another cell, so no apoplast. We put in the apoplast, which requires you to tweak parameters but doesn't massively change things. We model the cell as broken into bits, so these long, thin cells. We have perfect mixing within the bits and then something kind of diffusive between the bits. And you can have some lateral transport, some basal transport, some apical transport in all the different whatever's. And the take-home message is that this, you can't get the data with this, which isn't terribly surprising. You can do okay with this, and this is best, and it looks something like this. So if you just have one channel, you simply can't get that spreading unless you have so much apical transport that the entire thing is moving way, way slower than it does. So doesn't work. If you have, this is the three-channel model, and essentially what goes on is the auxin is moving down the down the stem exchanging between the different channels with some probability. And so some auxin winds up going fast, some auxin winds up going slow, and the bulk is kind of dragged along in between. And you can see the distribution of the auxin between the different channels over time, and you can get quite nice matches that way. And as I say, a reassuring thing is if you measure, if you don't add any auxin, you just take a chunk of stem, grind the whole thing up and measure auxin. So measuring auxin directly is incredibly tricky, and it relies you to be nice to your friends in Sweden who do the measuring. it's not trivial, put it that way. So we do that when we think it's important, but we don't do it unless we think it's important. So you measure the total amount of auxin in the stem segment at the beginning, and then you just collect how much comes out at the bottom over this kind of time window, and it fits this quite well, with the exception that it goes on coming out for longer than you would expect, so to speak, because there's some level of endogenous synthesis that seems to kick in.
So I'm trying to understand this business of channels.
Mm-hmm.
So if I understand correctly, these channels here are referring to your little model with sort of one file of transport, and that's not enough, especially if you assume that they're all moving at the same rate there.
Yep.
So you need to get these little stagnant pools, etc. But in reality, in the thickness of the stem, roughly how many files of this cell? Great.
So this is a section through a stem. This is pin 1, GFP, and this is another pin protein, pin 7. So there's a small family of pins, pin 3, pin 4, and pin 7, that are expressed much more broadly across the stem. The buds are going to be out here, and their vascular connectivity is you're going to come out of the bud kind of down into the screen, and you wind up the way the bud vascular strands work is they it's a bit weird actually. They plumb, so the leaf, if there were a leaf here, the leaf vasculature would be this would be so-called leaf trace. The bud vasculature would wind up plumbing into here and here, somewhat below the point where the bud intersects, and there are six vascular strands in the bud, in the bud stem, that come together to form two, and they then go kind of out and round and down into those two things at an angle that gradually converges, and it's very nice, but it's horrible to section, which is a real pain because nothing's straight. So they're going across this gap, essentially, which is, how many cells in that gap? It depends slightly what you count, all this kind of lovely phloem kind of derived stuff, but it's not that many, but because it's going at an angle, it winds up going through, it's, you know, five or six cell layers, but it goes rather slowly through them because it's also going down through them. So here's the pin 1 type shot I've shown you before, and here is pin 7, which you can see is considerably less polar. And all of these things contribute to the bulk auxin transport in the stem. So this is this bulk auxin transport assay where you just count how much comes up to the other end over 6 hours. This is an inhibitor of all of the pins to show you that it's inhibited. Here's a pin 1 mutant, which is seriously compromised, but if you start taking out these other pins, it gets less and less, so they definitely contribute. And if you make a triple mutant in pin 3, pin 4, and, oh no, this is pin 1, sorry. If you mutate pin 1 and look at these pulses, you can model them quite well by reducing basal auxin transport. You actually, you have to reduce it across, even into the less polar auxin transport regime. It's not the case that pin 1 is just doing the high one and pin 3, 4, 7 are just doing the other one. They share. But they're disproportionately contributing. So you can, yeah, it's not great, but it's kind of okay. And then pin 347 triple, you can do a slightly less good, but nonetheless okay-ish job by reducing the exchange between the channels, that lateral transport. rather than major effects on the basipedal. And the thing that I think is interesting is you in the model you get this very clear by two peaks. In the real data, the second peak, they're a bit shouldery, they smudge together, but it's reproducible. And I think that that's quite convincing evidence that the general idea of these different regimes with exchange between them is what's going on. And if you take out a big chunk of the slow regime, you wind up with, and the exchange between them, you've got some auxin that's stuck in the fast and going fast, and some auxin that's going slow in the slow, which is where you get these two things out of. So that tells you potentially that if there is this kind of canalization process going on, we've called this wider thing connective auxin transport, then it's actually a kind of two-step phenomenon where the bud is starting its auxin export journey across that domain, which is actually more that low polar domain, before it can connect into the high polar domain. And the establishment of pin 1 expression throughout this is concomitant with the establishment of this wider pin 347 domain that's part of the bud export machinery. And this is again backed up at least to some extent by physiological and genetic evidence, where if you just look at bud growth rates in pin 347, they're somewhat less than in wild type. And also rather interestingly, despite that those slow growth rates, the buds in those two node X plants of pin 347 mutants are really not able to talk to one another. So that connective auxin transport seems quite important for allowing a bud up here to inhibit a bud down here. And since they're on completely opposite sides of the stem, I think that's kind of plausible. The total branching in these things is not too bad compared to wild type. And so maybe these two things kind of compensate for the slow growth and the poor competition. And there are some other phenotypes because auxin does everything. So they're not very good at gravitropism, for example, then differently. And then...
Can I ask you a question here? So you're saying about the lack of communication because the plant on the right looks much more variable. So can you say that?
And what do you mean? So they're wavy and they don't stand up straight, because the shoots don't know which way is up. Well, they do know which way is up, but they can't do anything about it. Or they can't do as much about it as a wild-type plant. So that's why they look kind of
If I remember, is Max also, the striatolactin is also important for the pin 347 insertion?
We'll get to that. So triple pin 347 is quite good at suppressing branching in Max mutants, despite the fact that it has normal branching itself. And if you consider there's pin 1 also in there, that I think is quite impressive suppression. So that is consistent with this canalization idea. And this is Jen's question. So treatment with GR24 will rapidly strip pin 1s off the membranes. It does nothing to pin 3 and pin 4, but it does do pin 7. And we're quite excited about that, because that's specificity and allows us some way into identifying which sequences on the pins are targeted to allow the pins to come off the membrane in response to striatolactin. We've got all kinds of domain swap experiments going on. Okay, so then things fall apart even further, or something, because if you look at this pulse assay, there is absolutely no difference whatsoever between wild-type and striatolactone mutants, despite the fact that in these bulk assays, as I've shown you, there's quite a big difference between the striatolactone mutants and wild-type. So the pulses move very normally. The bulk, over time, doesn't. Now, how can this be reconciled? We don't really know, but you can certainly very easily get the same shape in the striatolactone mutants compared to wild-type plants whilst doing Max-like things. So if you increase all the transport in both the polar auxin transport stream and that wider connective auxin transport stream, both basal and lateral, then the pulses actually come out exactly the same shape. So that's kind of a relief, because that's exactly what strigalactone does. It puts extra pins in both of those places, both laterally and basally. So that's kind of a relief. But then we need to explain why there's a difference. By the time you get to the other end, you have to have more auxin moving through the system. And there are a variety of ways you can wave your arms around and do that. One way is to... So there are different... Okay, maybe I should just go straight on to... I don't know. There are differences between these assays which are frustrating and need fixing. And that's one of the reasons why we need to add auxin into that pulse. So either there's something to do with the auxin, the continuous auxin supply that you see in the bulk transport versus the pulse assay, or there's something to do with the fact that it's sitting in auxin for a very long time versus not. And this explanation is sitting in auxin for a very long time versus not. So maybe early on, the limiting thing in getting auxin into the transport stream is how much gets in, and over time, it's how much gets out. And max mutants get out more because they have more pins, but they don't get in more because they don't. So that's one option, so uptake limited versus efflux limited loading. And to try to address some of this, we invented this halfway house assay where it's more like the bulk assay, so we just stick the thing in auxin and wait. But we wait for different amounts of time and we do assay the middle segments. But it's not quite as fine-grained. The pulse assays are horrible because you're chopping these stems up into 2 millimeter pieces and counting each one in a scintillation counter. So this is chopping a slightly smaller bit of stem up into slightly bigger pieces and counting far fewer of them. And these are the kind of data you get. So you read... I think I've got this. So you reproduce the increase at the basal end over time, like in a bulk assay. You see this accumulation in the shoot tip that gets stuck, which we actually see in both assays. And then there's this middle thing, which I actually think is even more interesting, which we'll get to in a minute. So we've got this pulse assay where you've got your 10-minute incubation, and then you're waiting with no auxin, and then you're counting in these 2 meter long bits, or this continuous application assay where you're waiting for these amounts of time and chopping them into slightly bigger bits. And the standard bulk assay is kind of like that. And in the for wild type versus strigalactone mutants, exactly the same in this assay. Over here, we're recapitulating the increase at the end over time, which is good. Everything else looks quite similar, except there's less auxin at the apical end. And this, this is another annoying thing that comes back to haunt us every now and again, because max mutants have thinner stems, which we've always ignored in the past because we're arguing that they transport more auxin. And so if they have thinner stems, it doesn't really matter. But now that we've got this thing, we're wondering, is this just because they have thinner stems? So anyway, nonetheless, even putting aside the max mutants for a while, just this has a bunch of interesting features. So as I said, we've recapitulated that thing over the end. We've got no accumulation going on in the middle over time, which is quite a big deal. And then we've got this auxin stuck in the apex. And in our model, if you take the model that I showed you before and you run it, this bit is reproduced okay. The getting stuck in the end is basically not reproduced, and we strongly predict that this gradual increase in auxin in the middle bit over time should happen. And so I've done an incredibly crude version of something that we need to do properly, which is just kind of interpolate and extrapolate from our pulse data what would it look like if it were actually this continuous assay data. So you just add up, you stagger and add up all the things over time. And this is literally me doing it by eye, so it's rubbish, so don't overinterpret. But the general idea is that we see the build-up over time at this end. Obviously, it's longer and all the rest of it. We see the accumulation at the apical end that doesn't go away, which is the same as in the continuous assay, but we see this buildup in the middle. So the pulse assay gives us buildup in the middle, as does the model, and the model is based on the pulse assay, so that's not surprising. It gives us this at the end, which is fine, and it gives us more accumulation at this end than you would expect. I'm not too bothered about that for a variety of reasons. One, these points in the pulse assay are completely made up because it was really nothing going on. You can't interpolate, that's extrapolation. And also, it's actually not so difficult to explain accumulation at the apical end because we know that high auxin induces auxin conjugation and that would immobilize it. So I think this immobility, this accumulation over time at that end is not something I'm deeply worried about. I am interested in this differential loading possibility to try to explain some of this max mutant stuff. But this equilibration in the middle is really interesting because we have both data and the model predictions that we would expect this accumulation to happen over time in the middle. And in these continuous assays, it really doesn't happen. And that suggests some kind of feedback going on in the system that we haven't currently got for us.
So, I'm afraid I got lost. So in the model, your accumulation in the middle is because there are these stagnant pools that accumulate, right?
Yep.
And what puzzles me is, right, so there's somehow two parts of the story, right? So if you had some magic way of not perturbing the system at all, but dumping some magically, by optogenetics, making your auxin radioactive.
Yep.
And tracking the pulse in the completely unperturbed system. Mm-hmm. That would tell you something about the pipe that's there and how it's pumping.
Yep.
But you are transplanting this thing into God knows what concentration of auxin. And now the pins can rewire themselves. You can
all kinds of stuff can happen, exactly.
So there is some adaptation of the pipe.
Yep.
That's happening presumably on some comparable time scale, the different time scale. What if, right, there is a time scale of the pulse going through.
Yes.
And there's a time scale for the pipe to remodel itself.
Absolutely. And
they're not. Are they comparable?
We certainly can't rule out that they're significantly comparable. Let's put it that way. So that what we know about, if you just chop bits of stem off and watch pins, they go away over time unless you add auxin, which is another key reason why we need to keep auxin in our pulse assay. I think that's a really strong, urgent next experiment, which reduces the perturbation. But if you don't have auxin in this cutoff system, it will drain away over time. The time it takes is long. I mean, so we tend to look the next day because if you look the same day, you can see it, but not hugely. But that's for the auxin actually going away. There could easily be pin activity reprogramming, all kinds of things like that. Yes, absolutely, the perturbations could change the system, and absolutely, we really, really, really would like some systems that allow us to work without doing this.
You could do a pin stain in the course or after your concentration measurement. Mm-hmm. So you see how much the pins have changed.
Yes, and we effectively know that from these experiments where we look for in exactly these kinds of segments. At all the kinds of pins after some number of hours and all the rest of it. And the answer is after 3 hours, for example, you can't really detect much differences in how much of any of those pins are there. 5 you can if you really are lucky. But just how much is there is not the same as how much is active. This, I'm very intrigued by anybody's proposals for how that might work, because it could be absolutely the perturbation issue or some relationship between the added auxin and the perturbation issue. But actually, the perturbation we're doing, which is effectively chopping the top off, is a useful perturbation because that's a thing that happens. So, And then, so those are the kind of small questions, and the big questions are, more globally, how the properties of this system allow these communication things that we talked about, and also this huge question, which lots of people would like to know, which is, what is the flux, what's being measured? And any ideas on that is interesting. I have two more slides, which I will show, which are relevant to this question. Relevant to both questions, really. So I mentioned way back at the beginning that auxin moves into cells passively in its progenated form, but much faster with auxin uptake carriers. There are auxin uptake carriers in the stem, and those auxin uptake carriers have quite a big impact on how much auxin is transported. So there's a this is a quadruple mutant that completely lacks them, and it really struggles to get auxin down to the bottom of the stem in the 6-hour period or the 5-hour period that we're talking about here. If you just take out the major one, it has a significant impact. And if you take these auxin uptake carriers and you make double mutants with the strigalacto mutants, absolutely nothing happens to shoot branching. So whilst PIN347 suppresses shoot branching in these kind of strigalacto mutants quite well, I showed you earlier, AUX1 has no effect whatsoever, despite the fact that it significantly reduces bulk auxin transport through the stem. So I am in my head wondering whether that kind of information is relevant for trying to understand what this flux sensing thing is, and maybe it's specifically to do with efflux counting in some way and has nothing to do with influx counting in some way. And that's, I throw that out for speculation. And here is my lab, and I'd like to thank them and the funders and you for listening.
Talking about, when you're talking about the flux, I mean, most of you talk, you didn't really care about the auxin concentration, but once you go into your in vitro assay and you're putting a specific concentration of auxin, how does that relate, do you know, to what is the concentration in that piece of stem at that time?
So we use either 1 or 5 micromolar, which is high but not stupidly high. So the concentration in cells is... This is where the vacuoles become problematic. So if you take the tissue and grind it up, it's in the nanomolar, but most of the tissue is vacuole, and that's not where the auxin is. So 1 micromolar is not a stupid concentration. It could exactly be the kind of concentration that's in the relevant parts of the cells.
Going back to the question of what the cells are sensing, if I understand correctly, the model needs the cells to know what's the auxin concentration downstream. So, do you think counting efflux could give information on that?
So, what the model requires is it's horrible. It has to count net flux across the membrane. That's what it needs to do. And how do you do that? But there are more sensible things that you could count that correlate with that. Quite well. So we have some toy models looking at the kinds of things you could do. There's one where a pin protein stays in the membrane if it's active, and it's active if there's some auxin for it to transport, or as long as it can dump it into the apoplast. So we argue that if there's so much auxin in the apoplast that the pin protein is struggling in some way, then. It stays there if it's doing a good job, and it comes out if it can't do a job either because there's no auxin in it, because there's too much in the apoplast. And that you can do quite well with that, reproducing some of these canalization experiments. But it's purely speculative.
So the question I always wanted to know, but it was afraid to ask. So what's in the apoplast?
What's in the apoplast? So it's the cell wall, and so it's this kind of cardboard lattice that's differently rigid depending on where you are, and differently thick depending on where you are, and differently permeable to, I mean, differently kind of aqueous. So in some of these vascular cells, it gets lignified, and that's quite, it's quite nasty stuff that it's not permeable or anything. And so there are places in the plant where the apoplast is explicitly blocked to make sure everything goes through the symplast, where this plant has more control over it. So what gets taken up at the root tip has to go through the symplast. Otherwise, because there's these plugs, this Casparian strip in the endodermis that stops things going in. But so what that means is, you know, this is horrible because it's basically an aqueous solution, but it's an aqueous solution in a lattice. And estimating basic things like diffusion rates in the apoplast, it depends so heavily on which apoplast, where, and all the rest of it. And the measured values vary a lot in different parts of the plant. And so you could view this in a good way, because you have all kinds of options in your model. You could view this in a bad way, because you have no clue what's going on. And it's tricky.
Thank you.